You awake in darkness. Your mind is clear. But soon, you begin asking questions. Where are you? Who are you? Who put you here? With each of these questions, a crackle of electricity shoots around you, illuminating your surroundings. You realize you've entered the brainstorm. Welcome to RPB, the Role-Playing Brainstorming Podcast. All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new podcast that we are trying out called RPB, Role-Playing Brainstorming. And it is not just me, in case you're not watching the video version. I am joined by two very special people. First, we have Danal Godfrey, a friend of mine, longtime DM, GM. We can't say DM.
People just keep it sliding in. And that's the problem.
I know.
Hey, thanks for having me. I've been playing some form of role-playing game for, I don't know, 20 years, I guess, at this point.
Yeah, it's a family tradition for you.
It is, yeah. My dad was a games master, and he ran games, and he kind of got me into it. Actually wouldn't let me play until I turned 12, I think. So.
Good parenting.
Yeah, you know, let me watch and all that stuff. So I'd always pore over Monster Manual back in the day. And now I spend a lot of my time just watching people play online because it's impossible to get anyone together.
It's tough.
Yeah.
And also joined by Maggie Martin.
Thank you.
You guys have met before, right?
Yes, we have.
A couple times.
Okay, just making sure.
Yes. My wife and a relatively new game master.
Yeah, I've been running games for, I think, just less than a year, or maybe a little over a year. It's something around there. I can still measure the number of times in recent memory, and probably on a couple people's hands. It's not very long, but I've been playing for like 15 years or so, with my dad as the DM, and you, and most of my learning and figuring out how to be a DM has mostly been from watching you guys.
And I guess I'm Rick Martin, and I've actually been in the game a lot less than you guys because it was not a family tradition. I came from NASCAR, drag racing, hunting, fishing, no role-playing games in the house. But once I did discover it, I really got into it. Actually, my first boss introduced me to it. And
he introduced us too.
Yes, he did, actually. Hell of a guy. And what I lacked in like number of years total, I made up for in that period in number of hours played, I think, because for about 2 to 3 years there, we played at least every other week for at least 6 hours in a campaign that went from level 1 to level 29.
Well, a couple of those levels were kind of hurried, though, because that's what happens when you kill an entire like Mind Flayer city and you get like 4 or 5 levels at once.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we have a varying level of experience, but we all love what we do when it comes to game mastering games. It's a really wonderful experience, and whether you're been in the game for years or new to it, we're hoping everyone can find a little something in this podcast. And basically, role-playing brainstorming, we're going to talk about some different techniques that each of us use in order to brainstorm different ideas for our games. And that could be small things from just like a new item, or it could be hooks or characters, or, you know, the sort of skeletal frame for entire adventures. And we'll go through some brainstorming and also just talk about some of the techniques and maybe how you can use them to come up with ideas for your own games or steal some of ours as well. So feel free to. So to start out with, let's talk about how we come up with ideas a little bit, or some different tools that we use. I know you introduced me to something interesting that's a game based on brainstorming.
Yeah, so one of the main ways that I prepare for any game, and it has a little bit to do with my background. My educational background is English, so I teach composition and I teach literature. So always I'm doing a lot of reading. And anymore when I have to read for fun, I usually am reading games, reading different kinds of games. And many years ago, I came across this game designer by the name of Ben Robbins. His production company is Lame Mage Productions. And he has this series of games, all based around kind of a similar idea. The one that I would say he's probably most well known for is Microscope. And Microscope is a collaborative DM or GM-less game about history. I think he calls it fractal history. Because the idea is that you get together with one other person at minimum, or up to, I think, five people, and you decide that you want to tell a history at kind of a macro level, and then it gets kind of digs down deeper through various levels. And the game is set up in such a way that you can create any kind of history. It could be realistic, sci-fi, fantasy, doesn't really matter. In fact, part of the game is this conversation between the players as to what you want to create. So when Ben Robbins, the designer, was coming up with this game, he started to notice online that people were using it before they played
a campaign.
A campaign of other sorts, other role-playing games, mm-hmm. in order to create kind of homegrown worlds.
Sure.
Because one of the main things, and I don't know if you guys have experienced this, but I have this problem. Like, if I'm running a D&D game, I think is the best example of this. Somebody rolls a history check because they want to know something, because they're in a dungeon or they're in like a capital city. And if you're playing in like Faerun or the Dragonlance universe, there's the weird dissonance, because like, well, wouldn't my character know
sure.
this thing? Or, you know, all of a sudden you have to do like this big expositional dump of like, okay, well, you rolled a 20 on this, so buckle in. Let me read
this is going to be a couple pages.
Yeah, the 200-year history that brings you to this point. And for me, that creates a lot of problems, because if you don't know all that stuff or you're not deeply interested in it.
And plus, it's the DM having to come up with all this stuff. So the players are less likely to actually remember stuff.
Either that, or they have to, they have to have internalized and memorized entire fictional
history. It's particularly difficult in established universes. It's the main reason I haven't ran a Star Wars campaign for the Blind Wave crew yet.
Because they all have encyclopedic knowledge about it, and they're going to be correcting you all the time, for good reason.
Sure.
And a lot of times, even as a player, like, I don't usually care, to be honest.
Yeah.
Like, I'm doing the history check to, like, get past this
exactly
obstacle at this moment. Mm-hmm. It's just hard for me to care about who these ruins belong to beforehand. But if you start with a game like Microscope, you do create, because the way you play is you all get together and you use index cards and you kind of bookend the history that you want, a solid beginning and end, and then you add large periods of time where huge events happen, and then in each of those periods of time you dig down deeper to certain events, and then you dig down even deeper into scenes, so there is some actual role playing in the game itself, because you're trying to answer a question in those scenes.
Right.
But everyone plays together, you can create a whole mythology, a whole kingdoms, you can see everything rise and fall, and then when you actually play your Dungeons & Dragons campaign or Pathfinder or whatever, you can just pick a period of time and be like, well, I know this is a series of like 100 years, so this is when the game is going to be set.
You know, right.
Before this empire falls, but after this, you know.
And so the player's knowledge is actually based on what they are actually remembering.
They would have a basic level of like, oh, well, I know, because I grew up in this world, that mm-hmm. this is what happened. So.
Definitely, yeah. And it also, you know, makes everyone more invested, because like everyone's part of the process.
Yeah.
So, you know, people aren't lost, like the DM doesn't have all the tools. And, you know, that's something I want to mention as well, in that, you know, role playing is a collaborative process. And so you have the game master guiding things, but he's not telling the entirety of the story. You know, the players should feel that they should be able to contribute to that as well. And starting the groundwork of making the world together sort of starts that at square one, and I think makes players feel comfortable continuing that throughout the game itself, which is useful.
Yeah, for sure. And actually, to kind of back up that point, there is a sequel to Microscope called Microscope Explorer, a sequel, maybe appendix. It comes with more tools for running that game better. but actually it also comes with three mini games that deal with relationships in a family, like the history of a family, the history of a building or like a place or a thing, like you can see how that changes over time. And then another more specific one that, of course, I just forgot off the top of my head. That's how we play it fast and loose here with brainstorming. So I'd recommend picking that up if you want. The other thing I'd recommend is read some of the Powered by the Apocalypse engine games. Mm-hmm. Named after the first game that came out, Apocalypse World, by Vincent Baker. And then there have been...
We actually have one over there.
Yeah, Monster of the Week. I see you sitting over there off screen. So one of the key tenets in that is the idea that the games master, the storyteller, they all have different names, obviously.
The keeper,
whatever the name is. The idea is that they are just a player,
mm-hmm.
just like the player characters, and they have certain responsibilities, but they are not in charge.
Sure.
Really? So the main thing about those Powered by the Apocalypse games that I think you could easily port into traditional Dungeons and Dragons.
Any system, else, really.
Yeah, is the idea that if you as the DM or GM don't care about something, let your players make it up.
Yeah.
If they're comfortable with it.
Right? Oh, yeah.
If they're responsible enough.
If, yeah. There's a lot of ifs. Like, this is where, you know, consent is a very big thing. So, like, make sure you ask, be like, hey, I don't care about elves. Why don't you tell me what elves are like?
And sure.
And hopefully you know enough about your players that that's not a terrible mistake.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can definitely think of players. I'd be like, here's the reins. And other ones I'd be like, okay, let's wheel this back a bit.
Yeah, because there's so much cognitive load in being the traditional games master. You know,
sure.
You feel like you have to prepare for hours. You have to. It's like you're studying for a test that you're never going to pass.
Yeah.
Because they never ask the right questions.
They never do. They never ask the right questions. They always ask something else, and you're like, oh, but that's the one thing I didn't.
The first couple sessions were definitely felt like that.
I did not prepare for. So in some ways, offloading some of that responsibility, you know, not to sound too defensive, be like, well, why don't you tell me what it's like?
Yeah. And, you know, that's something else as well to where, I think every single game master falls into that early of like over preparing and trying to, you know, because you're nervous and you don't want to be on the spot and not know what to do kind of thing.
Because time feels like it suddenly goes so slowly as soon as you're not talking.
You have an expectation in your head of what you want it to be.
Yeah, you feel like everything just goes so smoothly when you're a player, but as soon as you start DMing, you're like, oh my gosh, there's been like 15 seconds of silence. What the heck do I do? Yeah. Why aren't they doing anything? Did I not tell them something?
Yeah.
But I think that brainstorming frequently helps you in your improv skills as well, and that you can just sort of come up with these ideas on the fly, and you don't have to rely on things that you've written down. And you know, what I started evolving into was I would write things that I thought were cool. And I was like, okay, I am content to never use this. Because, you know, you get attached to something, you put all this work into it, and you try to push it on the players. Whereas instead, I just started writing all these things down and made this library of things. And it's like, if we ever come into a situation where this is applicable, I can pull it out, it's ready to go. But otherwise, I'm just going to kind of let them do their thing, you know?
I was talking to a DM that was having those sort of issues where he was getting really, really invested in this sequence of events. And I was trying to tell him, like, if your players don't go into that room, it's not like that experience is lost to them. You just have it be the next room or put that room somewhere else. You can always just have it fold in somewhere else. Like, it doesn't have to be that physical room in that one dungeon that they're checking out.
Sure, yeah. I mean, you can take whatever's in that room and put it in another room they do go into.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's all kind of different tools and tricks and stuff that you can use. And, you know, we don't want to give away all the secrets on the first podcast necessarily, but we'll talk about it as sort of weeks go on.
As far as, like, especially with player collaboration, sometimes when I am a little at a loss, I start playing kind of a reverse 20 questions,
mm-hmm.
where depending on like what questions they ask me, tells me, okay, they're more interested in this bookcase or this wall, or they're getting really focused on the ceiling of this room for no reason that I wrote nothing for.
Yeah. So do you bow to the pressure? Do you suddenly make it like, well, yes, there is something in the ceiling. Like, do you...
Sometimes. Okay. Well, it's like when they're looking for something, when they're wanting more detail in the place, that means that, oh, maybe I said something that kind of clued them into something. Mm. I mean, obviously, if they're asking about this one piece of like ground that's just gravel, it's like, no, dude, it's just gravel sometimes.
Are you playing with a lot of newer players?
Or more experienced players? It's been half and half.
Okay.
It's been half and half.
Because I think I could do a whole episode on
new players
versus experienced players.
I love my new players. Okay. I got to say that. I really love my new players. But with my more experienced players, I've been getting really addicted to running the Goodman Games adventures for 5th edition. Mm-hmm. Because all their monsters are familiar, but the powers and such are just slightly different. So these players that know the dungeon, the monster's manual by heart, mm-hmm. all of a sudden I'm throwing them these ghost dwarf things at them, and they're like, wait, they're immune to this damage? Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, they are, dude. And they're like, oh, crap! And it throws them totally off, and suddenly they're actually playing and not just metagaming. Because I'm not good enough to actually change monsters yet, because I'm never quite sure if the balance is going to be right.
Ooh, let's talk about that. Can we do a segue? A segue into, like...
Sure.
I guess a recurring feature on the show?
Yes.
We'll just make it up right now.
Okay.
I don't know. Monsters. I got it.
Oh. Well, no. So, yeah. Moving on to the creature feature.
Hey, there you go. That sounds like
it rhymes.
Yeah.
It must be perfect.
Portion of the show.
Yeah, because I want to address that point. I don't care about balance.
Sure.
That's what Rick's been telling me. And last time I played, I kind of believed him. And went ahead and threw something really huge and freaking terrible that they should have run away from. Mm-hmm. And Rick told me it's made a really big impression. And basically, if they go into a situation, you want them to make the decision on whether to run or stay mm-hmm. really quickly and be able to make it really easily. So I basically made it as hard as possible, like did all the rolls straight and just took whatever it had and threw it at them. Mm-hmm. And they still stayed.
Yeah,
and they should not have been able to be, in my mind, an eye tyrant beholder at their level.
So this is an interesting thing, and you know, we live in a relative golden age, maybe much like when the game was first kind of created,
mm-hmm.
where there are tons of online GMs who have, you know, YouTube channels or Twitter.
A lot of resources out there.
A lot of things mm-hmm. to go out there and look at. And so, you know, when I go and I watch videos by like Matt Mercer or Matt Colville, a lot of Matts. Or Adam Colville.
It's like War Games with Richards.
Yeah, a couple of them around, right? One thing that I picked up immediately is everyone seems to be, at least everyone in that sort of sphere, because you got to be careful what sphere you go into. Everyone in that sort of sphere realized that while challenge rating is one thing, the true like test of difficulty is how many actions each side gets to take.
Mm-hmm. That's what, yeah, the number of attacks the creatures get.
So even if you notice like really low level monsters, like I think even just something like a bandit, I think can make 2 attacks technically. Like in the actual like
mm-hmm.
dungeon or monster manual.
Depends on the system.
Yeah, but so like 5th edition Dungeons and Dragons. Let's say we're talking about that specifically. Because yeah, different games handle difficulty very differently. A lot of D's. But in D&D, they've given a lot of monster 2 attacks, mm-hmm. like multi-attacks.
Sure.
Even for low-level monsters.
Mm-hmm.
Because they recommend for like 4 level 1 characters, they can handle a challenged rating 1 monster. Or like 4 goblins or whatever the math is.
Right.
But the thing is, if you got 1 bad guy and a party of 4, that 1 bad guy's going to get stomped.
Yeah.
Like he's mm-hmm. going to get hit 4 times
sure.
before he gets to go again.
That's, yeah.
So that is even where you're like, yeah, I've got this big bad monster and he's like so
but
tough.
But he's soaking
and cool.
up attacks yeah, from 7 different characters.
Yeah, but if they get hit a bunch,
and
it's going
to
go
and
down.
And not to mention, like, I'm there like 5th level characters. I don't know if you know this, but the monk is OP.
Yeah.
And like the fighter is getting double attacks as soon as he's out of his mother's womb.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
And fourth edition, as much as I love fourth edition, it did try to balance it.
Yeah.
And so it had solo monsters that, you know, the idea was you fight it on its own. And its trick was it had multiple attacks, but it also would have stun effects that could make characters not able to attack.
Yeah.
And that's just not fun.
Mm-hmm.
Either. Like, yeah. You know, basically it's like a skip turn in Uno, mm-hmm, kind of thing.
Yeah.
In a game where turns can take 10 minutes, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the...
Even when characters are dead or dying, they're still making the death save. So they're still... They've got some agency.
Yeah, but I mean, that's just it, right? So difficulty is one of those things where it just like, doesn't ultimately matter. And I think the other thing, too, is play around with how the two sides are kind of meeting. And remember that combat is still the role-playing part. Because I think a lot of people... And
sure.
I'm a victim of this, will sometimes switch off during combats, even if I'm running it.
Yeah.
With combat, it tends to be a really good place for my players to basically tell other players what's really important to them. So, mm-hmm, like, my rogue might grab the bag of gold and, mm-hmm, run out of the room real quickly. Like, make the calls, like, okay, we can't take this. I'm leaving.
Yeah.
And then they'll tell the other players, like, oh, if shit goes down.
What I always try to do is I always try to have a quick out to where if the players are sharp and they're paying attention to the environment, basically I'm designing them like a doom encounter where if they see the explosive barrel in the room, they're smart enough to fight the fight in a intelligent way, then, you know, they can do it. They can feel powerful, feel smart, and it's over in a few minutes. Whereas the worst case scenario is they have to play out the fight the way the writers of D&D, you know, and, yeah.
Oh, that's the worst case scenario right there.
You know, that's sort of the punishment, which isn't all that bad of a thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, you try to teach the characters and design these encounters in a way that it's not just this slog of going back and forth, but like, you know, if you read a book or watch a movie of a fight, like it's not this back and forth, you know, I take a turn, you take a turn, and it just sort of goes and goes and goes. Like there's a, you know, it's cinematic.
Mm-hmm.
And just trying to make the encounters at the table that sort of cinematic thing.
Yeah, there's a chandelier.
Well.
Use that.
Sure.
That's actually, do you want to talk about a particular creature or a type of creature?
Yes,
to make one?
Actually. I actually had an idea for one while I was taking a shower this morning.
Terrifying.
So I was in the shower and I was washing my hair and my scalp was a little itchy. And whenever your scalp's itchy, you always think of lice, right?
Yeah.
Sure.
Every time.
Every time. Every time. I've never even had lice.
Yeah, well, I'm not either, actually.
So I had this idea of mind lice.
Okay.
And the way it works is, to start with, they're just ordinary lice, okay? And you start itching your head and things like this. And I actually don't know how lice work. Do they eat dead skin cells? Is that how... Yeah,
it
not
depends
sure
on what stage of development they're at, I believe.
But they live in your hair and they eat and they, you know,
reproduce. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Live their lives, have parties.
Exactly.
Go to college.
So these lice start like that. But as they eat and they grow up and mature, they get to a point where they can burrow into your skull.
Mm.
And at that point, they become parasites in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Take the person over. And at that point, they feed on knowledge.
Mm.
So they start eating the person's knowledge and memories away, and eventually they will compel the person to go to like a library or whatever and just start reading until they die.
Oh.
It's pretty cool.
So okay, following that logic, then all of the schools of learning would have to basically vet people to make sure they weren't just going in there to read because they're infected with mind lice.
Well, see, and the thing I kind of wanted to brainstorm was I wasn't sure, like, is this a magical experiment gone wrong? Mm. Are these creatures that exist and are, like, prevalent, you know, in the world? Or
maybe it's like...
Because, what's the adventure around them?
Maybe it's industrial, you know, espionage?
Well, I mean, this is where... God, I don't want to have too big of a conversation about this, but... the genre of your game, I think, is going to have a big hand in this, right? You know, so are these Are these the main foe of the encounter or adventure? Are they the main thing that you're gonna have to deal with?
I was thinking that, like, the party sees this happening in the town, and this is kind of like the shadow before the storm, and that this leads to something bigger and scarier, right? So, like, they see this and they, figure out how to cure this, maybe, but this is only a small, like, scouting party of whatever the actual problem is, whether it's, they have to go to this tower where these things were created by an experiment and they have to deal with that wizard and all those terrible creatures or something else, you know?
So what do we think about? Okay, so first of all, is it important that we know where they come from?
It depends on if it's important to the players. Like, if the players go after it that way, then yeah, then I'd say the adventure becomes where these things come from, like that sort of thing.
Because this goes back to like the idea of a genre, right? So
Because I was thinking of like an investigation kind of
okay,
thing where,
so
like,
that's the type of adventure then.
yeah,
It's a
or in like a dark fantasy universe maybe,
okay.
or just a fantasy universe where there's something wrong with the town, like all these people are reading themselves to death in the library. It's like, what the heck is going on? And they're trying to follow the clues to lead back to the big bad.
Oh gosh, yeah, I could definitely see my players like getting hooked on. Oh, it's the books. The books are
Exactly,
enchanted.
right?
Yeah, trying misdiagnosing the symptoms, basically being like an extended version of like a Doctor House episode.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing, right? This is definitely like a Doctor Who episode or your classic like Body Snatcher.
I was thinking like X-Files.
It's a very good, like that kind of thing. But the thing is too is if it's like a dark fantasy, then the creatures probably just exist. It's probably just a
It's just a horrible thing you just have to watch out for. Like
yeah,
if you
because
itch your
like
head, some people
why do anything why does anything oh, this is a big question. Why does anything exist?
Sure.
In dark fantasy just to make it dark.
Let's talk about
Let's
that.
welcome to existential podcast. Where we question the meaning of existence. So if it's just dark fantasy, then it's like, all right, so are there universities? Yes. Are there schools of magic? Yes. Well, guess what? Something's gonna wanna feed on that knowledge.
I was kind of
Other
thinking,
than the student body.
like, I've been reading Doctor Strange comics
Nice.
recently, and there's a run where basically these people are trying to kill all of magic, and so they're destroying magic in these realms, and the things that feed off magic are migrating to places that still have magic, so they make their way to Earth. And like Doctor Strange is like, why are all these things coming that are only from, the tomb of Akamya or whatever? So I really like the idea of these lice being a forebringer of something that's much worse to come. And I was thinking maybe they could actually feed into that, where they're like the scouts of the army. And so they're telepathically linked to like a mind flayer creature, to where all the knowledge that they eat goes to the mother brain. And so, these creatures from another dimension or the abyss or whatever are coming in, and they have all this knowledge of Earth that they're using against like the people of Earth. And either they're, coming to fight an actual war, or maybe they're just like also doppelgangers and are trying to, take over things from the inside. Like, I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah, I think I like all those.
Oh, and then you have your players being very like worried if anybody seems to know a lot because like, oh my gosh, is it a doppelganger that's got access to information? So your players are running around like they can't do any knowledge-based DC checks because the DC is just way too high. And so they get really suspicious of anybody that can, even if it's like one of their party.
And I, yeah, and like having that sort of investigating thing continuing of like, okay, who's real in this town and who's maybe one of these creatures? And also having one of the creatures cast a spell on a player to start making them forgetting things, to make them think they're infected with the mind lice, But they're actually just under a spell and are starting to forget things, but it mimics the symptoms.
So I got a question then. My general rule of thumb has been to not do this too much, but I'd like to get your guys' ideas. Oh, when you come up with like an idea of a problem like this, do you also come up with like methods to fix it?
Yeah, I've encountered like you can't be too specific. This goes back to like some of the Powered by the Apocalypse stuff, where it's like even the games master should be surprised.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, that's what blanks. I consider like the big thing I love about being a games master is being surprised by the players. But I know Rick talked about like the exploding barrels basically in the room, setting those up for people to find.
Yeah, like you can have a way it's solved.
You need to have a way, because there's so many times where I've gone in and I've been like, okay, I'm going to let the players figure this out, come up with it on their own, and they come up with nothing.
Yeah.
And so I need a way to guide them to something.
Well, that's, you know, not to make it seem like this is planned, but just like you do in Microscope, you just have to bookend.
Yeah.
Like you have to have a beginning and a conclusion.
Sure.
And particularly with this kind of investigation, the conclusion that you have, you could basically write two or three small conclusions, right? Mm-hmm. Because the conclusion is party succeeds. They stop the whatevers. And maybe that's just part one, because the other conclusion could be party succeeds and they find out that the mind lice are emissaries.
Yeah.
Scouts, right? And then, of course, you have the option for like the party doesn't succeed.
Sure.
Right? And so that's your bookend. Basically, as soon as you have that down, you can just start filling in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, working your way backwards. One thing that I've picked up from those Apocalypse Engine games and even more games like Blades of the Dark is just making little ticking clocks where you just draw a circle and you kind of like bisect that circle with a series of lines. So if you just do two lines, then you've got four wedges.
Mm-hmm.
And each wedge is like moving the main plot forward. So
are they in an order?
Oh, I like that.
Essentially, because it's like, all right, party arrives at town beset by mind lice. How long until it's over? How long do I think they need?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think they've got some time, so maybe I'll give them eight wedges. By the time half of the circle is filled, I'm like, okay, most of the town is beset by mind lice. The players haven't done anything yet.
So how do you know when you fill in a wedge?
So in the games that this comes from, it's usually when players will fail.
Okay.
They don't discover something. They mess up a role. A lot of those games have this kind of failing forward.
Sure.
Where they might succeed, but something bad will happen.
Like a good game of Cthulhu.
Pretty much. Right?
Failing forward.
And you can do this stuff in Dungeons & Dragons as well, you know, because that's, I think, the main game that a lot of people are familiar with, just conceptually. But one thing that I've always hated is the idea of, like, I'm a rogue. I've been statted to pick locks.
Sure.
I'm encountering just a garden variety lock, not even, like, a plot important specific lock.
Yeah.
I roll lock pick, and I brick it. I get a one.
Yep.
And I can just keep rolling the die until it happens.
Sure.
Or, because you as the games master can decide to do this kind of stuff, you can say, all right, you roll the one, you open the lock. There are guards on the other side.
Right.
Right? You just instantly escalate. You create a bad effect.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That's tied to the roll, so it's both mechanically and fictionally relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And in much the same way of this, they're investigating.
Sure. Yeah. Like, something to mention is a lot of people think of roles in games being like you were saying, of, you know, you're trying to do this thing and you fail to do this thing. But you should think of it in a broader context of, you know, this world isn't set in stone. Mm-hmm. And like, it doesn't really exist in a manner before that role in the same way it exists after that role. So like, you know, you generally describe this mountain or whatever, and then like there's a climbing check, and you know, you can add details to that mountain based on their failure that says, oh, this is why you failed. It's because it's sheer, or because, you know, it's covered in ice or something like that. Like, you don't just have to say, you know, you failed because you're bad at your job. Like, you can alter the world in a way to explain why they failed this thing that they should have succeeded.
Yeah, basically, for when I have players trying to do a DC check, I try to, I say, okay, describe what you're going to do. And so they start coming up with things that they are imagining are to do with this climb check. Like, oh, I'm going to use my rope and I'm going to tie it around, and they just make up, there's a little rocky outcropping, and I'm going to swing to the side and kind of run up the side of the cliff to try to figure it out. So the more they describe it, they add details to the situation, then I can affect the DC to make it easier on them. So, because the more I can get them to describe stuff, the more they are actually paying attention or are active in the game, the more they are, like, excited and doing stuff, is the better.
And I have a feeling in this series we're going to talk about Pendragon a lot.
Yes.
Because
I'd like to.
It's one of the best out there if you've never tried it. And it explicitly states, like, if their idea is good enough, they don't need to roll.
Yeah.
It just succeeds.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's something that I try to encourage in all of my games, of where that is a good enough idea, you've thought this through, that it just happens. Because, you know, the roles are there for, like, story purposes, to add, like, randomness to a thing and to add, like, a chance of failure. Mm-hmm. And, like, but it's all for the purposes of the story and having fun. Mm-hmm. And where if the thing that creates the best story or the most fun involves them succeeding, maybe they don't even need to roll for it.
So what's your guys's level? When do you decide that it's been enough description? So, like, my general kind of rule of thumb is when I can, they, as they're talking, if I just close my eyes and I can see it kind of happening like a movie in my head clearly enough, then I'm like, okay, that happens. Like, if it's become a movie in my head because they've described everything well enough, then that's works.
For me, it depends. It's basically player by player. I think if the player challenged themselves, then it's good for the story. It can happen. Mm-hmm. So, like, if it's a new player, and we talked about new and experienced players before, I set the bar lower for them to encourage them to do it and to get better at it. Like, I'm not going to expect, you know, a Shane to do the same thing that I would expect a Don to do to necessarily get that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's with description. I think it's best to remember that these games, since they do take place in a shared imagination, are entirely based on our conversational skills.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone has very different levels.
Yes.
Of that.
Yeah.
So I am more and more, anytime I play, I am removing any artifice that I possibly can. And I think this comes up more in character interactions, NPCs and PCs, not mm-hmm. player and player character, than it does in, like, describing the world. I'll describe the world in as much detail as people want. And if they ask questions, mm-hmm. I'll come up with more stuff, and I'll generally try to give them the scene as they need it. But when it comes to, like, non-player character motivations, like, if I'm just not coy about it anymore. I'm just like, you know, he's lying.
Sure.
Like, mm-hmm. you can tell. Right? Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, there are roles for that, particularly in games like Dungeons & Dragons. But at the same time, a lot of those roles are just to get, like, a not necessarily good bit of information.
Yeah.
Right? Like, oh, I'm having this conversation, I'm going to roll insight.
Sure.
Is he lying? Well, that's just a yes-no.
Yeah.
You don't actually get to know.
And, you know, it's something in that world, like, you know, if you have a character that has a high, I believe it's insight in Dungeons & Dragons that gets that, like, you know, that character is going to be looking for body language for that person.
Yeah.
And, like, that's a hard thing to role play necessarily, like, if you're not an actor.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, if I'm trying to say something that isn't real, but I'm also trying to say it as if I'm lying as that character, like, you know, you as the player might not be able to pick up on that. So that's kind of what the roles are there for. But I agree with the idea that, you know, especially in that sort of role-playing section of it, try to take as many mechanics out of the mix as possible.
Yeah. And that actually goes back to the idea of these, like, mind lice. So if you have it start and end, so we describe what the end was. And if you have the art start be something where the players aren't even there yet, you know, like Subject Zero
mm-hmm.
enters town. Right? So that's already started. From then on, it's little steps like players interview people. And that's a big step of, like, okay, how are they going to start telling who is infected and who isn't?
And
does it affect different people differently? Like, say you keep saying it's a little town. Like, what if someone that can't read gets infected? Yeah. Like, how are they going to get information?
Well, let's move to our next segment, supporting cast, where we come up with a character that maybe someone encounters.
Yeah.
Okay, the person with immunity is the person who cannot read.
Okay, well, so if we're fleshing out this little, like, investigation, mind lice, we'll have to come up with a better.
What?
I know. I mean, it's very descriptive, but, you know, now we're kind of doing a whole adventure for our listeners.
About the players, whoever the wizard is in the character that, like, discovers them or something like that, then he gets to name them. So it becomes, like, Pelagius's dark lice or something.
Don mentioning coming up with the adventure for our listeners. If you are interested in supporting the show as well, we're going to have a PDF of some of the things that we're talking about that players or listeners can purchase if they so wish. I'll talk more about that at the end of the podcast, but go on.
So this is a pretty canned kind of, like you said, an X-Files investigation. So for instance, if you were to pick up a game like Monsters of the Week, I'm considering going to go get that book real quick, because it has a whole section on how do you make a mystery.
Go ahead.
I'll go do that real quick. And we already done the first part, which is have a monster that people investigate.
Sure.
And the next step is, who else is there?
Yeah, so I actually haven't seen much X-Files, but I have seen Witch Hunter Robin, which is basically the anime X-Files, but with witches and things like that. And, you know, there's a lot of Monster of the Week kind of shows, but like...
Yeah.
Well, and the back of the book mentions Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Supernatural, a few others as well.
There are tons of these shows now. So I guess I'll introduce it to Monsters of the Week by Michael Sands. Is a Powered by the Apocalypse game.
We just got this in mailbag, so thank you.
Yeah, this fans. Is by Evil Hat Productions. They do a lot of really good Powered by the Apocalypse, Forged in the Dark kind of games. And this comes back to an earlier point that I made where read widely. When you can.
Definitely.
Right? Like, read other kinds of games. If you've only ever played Dungeons & Dragons.
Fiction as well. And you'll get ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially, like, those history podcasts we listen to.
Play video games. Play The Witcher 3.
Yeah.
There's tons of ideas.
Listen to, podcasts, watch documentaries. I was just watching an interview with the guys who did the Lego movie.
Mm-hmm.
And, Clyde has a Chance of Meatballs, and like they do a couple other projects, and they describe their process for coming up with things. It starts with them just like, I just read this article about this cool butterfly. How can we use that?
Awesome.
When we're doing this movie.
And, pre-written adventures are good and useful.
Yeah.
And also useful for just stealing things from them and using them in your games as well. Like, you don't have to run the whole adventure. Just.
Yeah.
Dissect them and take the pieces you like and twist it however you want. Like, you don't need to be the most creative person on earth to be a good game master. Like, steal.
Yeah. Like, there's just nothing new under the sun. I mentioned before, I do teach literature and I teach writing.
Mm-hmm.
It's all the same stuff, right? There's like, 7 kinds of stories that have ever been told.
Sure.
So if you feel like, I'm kind of a hack, and like this is just this episode of this show that I watched, but I've just changed like 4 things, your players will never know.
Oh, yeah, I definitely, I need to watch this show because none of my players do, and I could just take an episode, and there it is.
Actually, speaking of, in a game of Pendragon, so this is, I guess we're going to need a bingo card for the podcast already. One time we were playing Game of Pendragon, and I entirely ripped the murder plot from an episode of Game of Thrones,
which I had not watched yet.
You had not?
No, none of us had watched. And so we were like, oh, I just my used gosh. That.
And I thought it was brilliant. And
Don
I
just pushed those kids out of the tower.
Well, that's different. That's another one.
It was one of the most memorable moments in that campaign. Actually, I don't think anyone in that game had seen Game of Thrones except you.
No, that's why I say no one had seen it. And so we were all amazed. And then we watched Game of Thrones and we're like, oh.
But,
that was brilliant.
It was also a twist on it. Like, it wasn't.
Yeah, it wasn't directly.
That's just it, right? Like, if you do, like, the barest amount of palette swapping.
Yeah.
Yeah, I as I remember, it wasn't a crime of, like, this is a useful time. I'll just do this. Like,
yeah.
What happened in the movie? You actually took them up to the top of the tower and then threw them off.
Well, and really, like, you're just coming up with the premise. And, like, the way it plays out is going to be different because you have these live people interacting with it. But let's get back to Monster of the Week.
Yeah, so Monster of the Week, which is an investigation type game, right? You play monster hunters of whatever flavor you want. Their rules for being like Hellboy style BPRD, rules for being supernatural, for Buffy, Angel, any of those types that you want to be, you can be those types. But the main goal of this is that you're going to a town or a place investigating spooky happenstances.
Very spooky.
So they recommend that, then they have a process in the book for how to come up with, well, what is happening? And they say, you know, start with the monster, figure out what that is. And they have example monsters. Mm-hmm. They usually say, like, oh, start traditional for the first couple games, vampires, werewolves, ghosts. And then start coming up with
crazy
new stuff. From there, then, they recommend deciding who are the bystanders.
Okay.
You know, the victims, witnesses.
The supporting cast.
Yeah, the supporting cast, you might say. And how are they different than, you know, the minions, the people who are working with the monsters, but aren't necessarily monstrous themselves, right? So this would be a good time to be like, all right, mine lice, they were this scouting force. Is there a cult involved? Is that too complicated?
Right.
I want to leave that part out. Like, yeah, is it a wizard's fault? You know, that's where you can have that character. But this is where, as a games master, you have to kind of decide, like, all right, how big do I want this to be?
Sure, like, know? Is this a one-shot? Is this the start of a campaign?
Yeah, right? Yeah. And then from there, you know, when you go for bystanders, the Monster of the Week has suggestions of, like, archetypes.
Mm-hmm.
And these are very important archetypes. And, of course, depending on what game you're in, you just have to, like, kind of swap the names around. So,
sure.
People who are nosy, people who are ultimately just victims, people who...
The guy that everyone thinks is crazy, but he actually knows what's going on.
Yeah, you know, those kind of things.
Your guest stars.
Yeah, police officers or, you know, the kind of people you see in these investigation shows.
Yeah.
Like, for a while, with Supernatural in particular, you'd watch that show and be like, okay, so you got the two leads and, like, their ally. And then they're going to introduce two new people.
Right.
One of them is going to get killed, and the other one's the bad person.
Sure. Like a Scooby-Doo episode.
Yeah. There's not anything wrong with that.
No.
It works. But... If anything, yeah. Did you guys watch the Scooby-Doo crossover?
And also, here's the love interest for this week.
Yeah, exactly, right? And that's the same thing you can do in this game. Is like, all right, well, how many people do I need? Right? Because I can just have generic descriptions of people, but who actually needs fleshed out?
Yeah.
Who needs real... motivations.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you guys thinking? How many bystanders should we make for this?
I usually keep it down to as few as possible because players don't remember names.
Yeah.
So we'll have
so the characters three. Have to be memorable. Okay, so three main ones. Just bystanders?
A person in power.
Okay.
A person with absolutely no power.
Okay.
And the person who is emotionally like manipulative or connecting to people.
Okay, so a red herring?
Like...
Yeah.
You know, the villain, the clue giver, and the one that the party wants to save.
Yeah, right. Basically. The emotional connection, the person has no power but has knowledge.
Yeah. So what's great about this, right, and I'm glad to see you're both on the same page.
We are married.
I learned from him.
Well, I mean, just the idea is, yeah, you want to be broad starting out, right?
Yeah.
Like, what is the actual purpose of this? Pawn this, you know, kind of paper tiger that we're going to be using to keep the game moving. Because that's the thing. So the idea, and if we go back to the idea of the ticking clock, right? Subject zero shows up probably before the players are there.
Sure.
Then players arrive, realize something's wrong. This should be in the first, I guess depends on how hard and fast you want to make the game run, either in the first hour or the first 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Right? Kind of depends on your time scale. Mm-hmm. And then the next step is the players have to do these interviews. And you can say that, you know, you interview tons of people, but here are the three important ones. These are the only ones we're actually going to, like,
focus on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
These are the only ones that we care about.
Yeah, like, you know, you can wave a thing away of like, oh, this person has nothing useful to say. Or like, you know, he talked your ear off for an hour about his vegetable garden.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to have that conversation. You can just explain the conversation and move on.
Yeah. So then from there, we can come up and flesh out these just three major NPCs. And what do you guys think? Would you give them stats or not?
I mean, I would give the villain stats.
Okay.
Yeah. If he's going to be an encounter, like, you know, I was thinking you could have like a lieutenant or whatever that is like taking all this information in and sending it back to the mother brain. And so he is masquerading as a townsperson, probably someone in power or someone of influence who is hand waving away all this sickness. Like he could be the town doctor. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, you know, this is this disease that all these that are driving these people crazy. Mm-hmm. And like, why don't you take this tonic that actually helps the mind things, you know, or something like that.
Yeah.
The snake oil salesman.
Well, but who is actively
mm-hmm.
thwarting the efforts of the adventurers.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he shows his true form, and then they have to fight this terrible parasite, God. Resident Evil
his
4
head
style.
Explodes and it's a giant bug.
So would you do the same thing, Max? Would you just stat up the main...
I think...
The sub-boss, I guess. Because you can't really fight the mind.
I like the idea of basically having them slowly realize that one of their number is actually infected.
I also can't wait until the solution is all of the adventurers shave their heads.
That occurred. That did occur.
Yeah, that could be a thing, right? Yeah, because what I like most about this kind of monster, and we'll come back to these NPCs here in a second, because I think they're going to be the main thing that your whole adventure will hang on.
Sure.
Because mm-hmm. this goes back to like, well,
that's
why,
how they're going
to
get their
why
information.
Do the players care?
Yeah.
Also, is that this kind of adventure you can't just fight everyone,
right?
Like mm-hmm. there's a moral choice that will probably come up at mm-hmm. some point. Like particularly if, say, if it's you know, a step away from midnight, if we're using our ticking clock metaphor,
mm-hmm.
and it's like, well, the town's overrun, so either you come up with a cure or you're going to have to
burn it all down.
Yeah, make some sort of containment.
I can think of
Raccoon City.
Imagine players deciding, oh, it's in their head, chop off all their heads, and keep it from spreading.
This is where you'll have to like come up with some sort of morality conversation with your players. And I guess the main way to enforce that morality is these two other NPCs.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Right? Minimum of people who have knowledge of the situation, or at the very least, they are.
Or like, you know, Maggie was saying, the other one that isn't acting weird is the guy that can't read, you know? So like, that's the clue.
Yeah, could be done.
Where he, you know, knows something because of his ignorance.
Yeah.
Like that.
I think is
because
a fun.
Because they generally like, oh, like we need more information about this. Mm-hmm. So we'll go to someone with lots of information. Or you go to the village idiot. It's like just turning the player's preconceptions on their head, basically.
So one thing that I find difficult is we've decided we definitely want one of the NPCs to be like an emotional hook for the characters to get mm-hmm. them to like care about what's happening and perhaps be worried that something bad might happen to this character.
Sure.
Generally let the players choose who it is because they'll get weirdly connected to somebody no matter what you do.
That was going to be my thing, right? Do we continue this idea of like, do you just ask? Like, who would you...
I mean...
You've interviewed all these people. What is a type of person that you would care about?
Well,
do you try to create...
The easy way to do it is the one that can offer the party the greatest reward.
Yeah.
Right? That's the cheap way of doing it.
Yeah, it's pretty mercantile, right?
But sometimes that's what the players need.
If we don't do this, we won't get paid.
Yeah, right? Exactly. But, you know, the more interesting way is... You know, someone that one of the party members falls in love with, or a child that, you know, starts hanging around.
An innocent of some kind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Or just, you know, a really funny, clever guy that they want to hang around with.
Yeah.
A dog.
A dog.
Well, that's just it. Like, and I think that's the part that you're going to have to.
An old woman that makes some cookies.
Yeah.
Yes.
You're going to have to really think up and try to read your party, which I know is difficult for new GMs and DMs. This is where the conversation will just have to come in
mm-hmm.
to figure out like what would be.
A lot of times I found
or what would be
well, and
a
you know,
that you can make.
It's a little more difficult if this is your first game with them. But if you've been playing with them, you know, just keep an eye for.
You'll and, start to know their types.
You know, make notes of, you know, who did they latch on to? Like,
what are they most interested in?
And what, you know, what motivated them to pursue this action, you know? And just sort of keep that in mind when you, in the future, try to come up with new adventures of like, well, players aren't going to change a lot, I feel like, and that they're going to be motivated by the same thing over and over a lot of times.
Yeah, this is where actually...
Look, our players aren't dumb, we swear.
Well, just some people, they just like a certain kind of fiction.
Yeah,
that's why you play the game that you like. Which is why, actually, if you do this as a one-shot, I'd recommend having somebody in the party be related to your emotional tie in the town.
Or if you're starting the campaign...
Oh my gosh, this could be totally like a dementia ripoff, like, oh, he's slowly losing his mind. Oh,
yeah, no. I mean, just something, right?
Like, and then the emotional hooks be like, oh, you got him back.
You like, you build amazing. This connection, like, particularly if it's the start of an adventure or if it's a one-shot. You know, if it's a one-shot, you could play a lot harder.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because, like, when the curtain comes down, everything's going away, you know?
Yeah.
So it doesn't really matter.
It doesn't matter if they get gold, really, because they're not going to spend it. So.
Yeah, like, because, you know, everyone will cease to exist after the game's done. But these ideas of, like, pushing your players to... Pushing, I guess, is the wrong word. Asking your players to build these realistic connections, where it's just like, hey, you got a letter from home.
Yeah.
Things seem weird. Like, you have this long letter, and then this letter. And once again, you don't have to write the letter. You don't have to, like, artisanally craft a real prop. Can if you want to. I've done it sometimes, it's fun, but once again, it's a time sink.
Yeah,
you don't even have to like write something in character. You can just literally do what I just did, which is like, hey, you got this letter from home, and like, it's your sister or your mom or your grandfather or like whoever you think make the best connection for this player character.
Sure.
And ask them, ask leading questions is I think the best advice that I can ever give. So it's like, hey, who is the relative that you're closest to,
right?
Is a good leading question.
And if you're a player, be immediately suspicious.
Yes.
Because that because that character, that person is going to be in mortal danger.
Yeah, regularly. But it's so good, right? Like, who is the family member you're closest to? When was the last time you went home? Two great beginning questions for this adventure.
Yeah.
Because then the inciting incident is like, oh, you get a letter. You get a post.
I worry like, a little bit weird. About, like, connecting it too strongly to one player, just because I worry about the other players kind of like checking out a little bit.
So I can understand that, but I also hate going the other way.
Yeah, it's like making it unconnected.
It's like
to everybody.
Everyone's from the same town. Like, because sometimes people are against that as well. So this is where you're like, you just ask the question. So that's why I wouldn't ask any one player necessarily. Like,
sure.
You would start, so if your three questions are who are you closest to in your family, what is the last time you went home, the first question is, hey, who is from this town,
right?
And you just ask the whole party,
and they, then if like more volunteer.
Than one, well, yeah, if more than one person says, oh, me, then you could have a series of questions to follow down in, right? Okay, so you both are from the same town, like, did you know each other before you went adventuring or whatever? And then you just keep kind of digging down and asking a lot of these questions.
Because
the answers that you get is to create buy-in.
And I think that we've given the listeners enough to work with that they can take this idea and maybe continue to run with it themselves.
Yeah.
As we move on real quick to the final segment, the final segment this time, I encourage you... we will have an email. Let's say that the email is rpb@blindwave.net. I should be able to make that email address. where if you want us to sort of brainstorm an idea that you have, like a kernel, we'll do that at the end of the podcast.
Yeah.
So send that in and we'll take sort of the best one and we'll do that. But for the final one of this is going to be what's in the box. Where we simply, the party opens a chest or a box of some sort, and basically we're just making a quick random loot table. Each of us comes up with two things, so you'd roll a d6, and that's sort of where it comes from. My first thing is going to be ripped pretty much directly from the new God of War game, where you open the box and inside is a talking head. And this talking head knows all about the dungeon that they happen to be in and can help the players. What their motivation is kind of up to you, whether they want to get back to their body or get resurrected, or maybe they're evil and want to get back to their magic book so then they can fight the players or something like that. But make them really charming and funny and helpful that the players want to carry this head around.
I know players that just want to carry it around because it's a head.
Yeah.
Like, they probably already have heads on their costume somewhere.
But, you know, in the newest God of War game, there's a character in that that's a talking head, and he's great. Was one of my favorite characters in a video game a long time, and I just kind of want to have that in a role-playing game.
Plus, it gives the DM an outlet to role-play a little bit constantly.
Yeah. Do a bunch of exposition in a way that like makes sense. Are we doing one thing each?
And then yeah.
The background.
Sure.
Okay. So you open the chest, and inside is a pouch of 50 gold.
Okay.
Whenever you spend this
gold. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Give me a second. Whenever you spend this gold, it will come back to the purse at the end of the night.
Ooh.
Right. So every day the gold comes back.
So it's like a coin on a string in a vending machine?
Pretty much.
If you travel fast enough, it's okay.
Yeah. So this is like a lightly cursed object because, you know, some players may not appreciate the trouble that it'll bring if they try to purchase things with this 50 gold. because ideally, the shopkeepers will notice.
I think as a DM, I would make it like the coins to be of like an extremely old vintage so that they are
different. They're unique in some way.
In some way that they could be traced back.
Yeah.
Definitely.
You can follow the coin trail.
Yeah, it, like, exactly.
Leaves like a snake.
And pretty soon, the word might get around. It's like, oh, don't accept any coins with the left-facing king or something like that. You know,
you get like an etching put up where it's like we no longer accept coinage from.
And then it's like that could come back around. It's like, oh, they come to this inn very far away. It's like they won't accept my coin. It's like, oh shit, that'd be great. My idea was that a bunch of parchment that's just blank. That whatever is drawn on it becomes real. And I know that seems like a really wide thing, but
I think that's great.
You could limit it as to where like colored inks would matter, drawing ability, so you could have DCs set for like how well the person can actually draw. You could have the players themselves actually draw something and say, okay, you've got this now. It looks terrible. Or you could also, and you can also limit it by, say, the size of the parchment. Say if they want a little tiny key or something, they could rip off a little piece and draw a key, and then that appears. And they're also limited by, obviously, how many sheets of paper they give you. Mm. So that seems like a really nice thing. Say if the players don't have lockpicks, it's like you don't want to bog down the game and slow it down by like, oh, you don't have lockpicks. Use a piece of your paper. And that's just a kind of a time saver. And also they can be really creative and actually draw something at the table and be cool.
Yeah.
So my next one is you open a small box, and inside is like a silver hair clip, but it's for a beard. Mm-hmm. And it only works for dwarves. But basically, while you have this in, your intelligence stat is through the roof in whatever system that happens to be. Mm-hmm. You know all languages. And like you're just crazy intelligent. But the downside is you cannot remember anything that happens to you.
Okay.
So, like, you don't know the party members. You don't know what you're doing. Like, you just have this horrible state of, like, amnesia where, you know, you might not know how to swing your sword. Like, it boosts your intelligence and it gives you this wonderful knowledge. But everything else, you're just worthless. And...
Oh, gosh.
You find yourself in this combat encounter, and you all of a sudden forget where you are. You forget who's on your team.
You could also tweak it to where they would never remember anything that happened to them just while they had the clip on. And so you could, like, oh, I trust you guys not to mess with me, right? You're not going to mess with me. And it's like they put the clip on, they do all the checks. And then the other player's like, oh, let's shave his head. And he'll never remember who did it to him. Letting the players like come up with those fun little role-playing things That would be hilarious.
That could be a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's really good. So mine, you open up the chest, and inside is a pair of very nice knitted wool socks.
Ooh.
And when you wear them, you're filled with confidence, and you're made much more comfortable. So you are granted advantage on the next two rolls.
Oh, nice.
Confident socks?
Yeah, because you just feel so good.
Do you wear these on your feet?
Yeah, I mean, you have to.
Okay.
Yeah. These go in your feet slot.
Okay. I like giving players things that don't appear to have any, like,
benefit.
A great deal of benefit or value for, like, combat or encounters or something. But like that, I mean, that's obviously helpful because like that's actually like affects rolls and stuff.
Yeah, I mean,
that's
they
fancy.
Have to put it on
that's
to
great.
Find it out though.
Yeah,
you have to
that's
attune
true.
To the socks.
You have to spend a pearl to identify.
Yeah.
Gosh. I had the idea of temporary tattoos, basically.
Yeah.
That you put them on with like water or whatever, and then they might change some sort of aspect about you physically. For a short period of time, like you put one on your hand and maybe your hands become like orcish, or you put one on your face and all of a sudden it's like you don't appear to be have any facial hair, or just like changes something physically about you. I mean, they'd be great for like short-term disguise sort of things, and then they just like slowly wear off, rub off, like normal temporary tattoos.
I like this idea of like magical henna.
Yeah It's pretty good. So you don't want that commitment of like,
yeah, I don't want to actually become an
magical,
orc, but for
yeah.
one night, yeah.
You don't want a commitment of magical tattoos. You just want to, like, impress your friends.
Yeah, and maybe there's, like, a really easy way of telling. Maybe they are water-soluble,
yeah.
So, like, you don't want to go out in the rain.
Yeah,
or, like,
works.
After, if you put one on and have an amorous night with a barmaid, it's like, uh-oh, maybe it gets rubbed off.
The tattoo?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Depending on where you put it. But like, I feel like that could open up a lot of really hilarious role play opportunities for the players.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, thank you guys. That is what is in the box. And that is the role playing brainstorming podcast for this episode. Not exactly sure how often we're going to do this. I haven't decided yet. But let us know your feedback at rpb@blindwave.net. And also, send us your ideas that you want to brainstorm. Just email us there to get a hold of us. If you want to support the show, check out blindwave.net shop. There's going to be a PDF there that I'm hoping to release every podcast about sort of what we talked about in a form of something that you could actually use in a game, like a supplement kind of thing. I'm going to give that a shot. We'll see how it turns out. And yeah, do you guys have anything to plug before we...
Yeah, I don't have anything in the works. Well, that's not true. I'm actually working on a role-playing game very glacially, slowly. just because, you know, I have a kid. And
yeah, kids
a
slow
job
down.
And stuff. But if people want to, they can give me a follow over on Twitter. I tweet occasionally. I just had a big thread about the Hobbit animated film.
Nice.
Because I love it.
And where would that be?
Over at Theory, W-O. Context. So Theory Without Context.
Okay.
That's my handle. So you can give me a follow over there, because I think you can find either of you pretty locally at Blind Wave.
Normally so, yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I actually can't even remember what my Twitter handle is at the moment.
Archmaster7.
It's probably Archmaster7.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember what my Twitter handle would be.
You guys gotta get on that game. That social media game.
Like, I never tweet. I just use it to follow you guys.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We hope you enjoyed, and we hope to see you next time. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Later.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of RPB, Role Playing Brainstorming. Today's hosts were Richard Martin, Danal Godfrey, and Maggie Martin. The intro music was The Other Side of the Door, by Kevin MacLeod at incomptech.com, incomptech.com.